Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, it's Francis. This week, we're going to go back to an episode from last year about getting ready for the holidays. Some great gift ideas await. Check it out. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. This week, we're all about gifting, hosting, and guesting for the holiday season. Because we're hoping that we're heading into a holiday season that's still full of gifts, treats, and maybe even other humans. So maybe time to brush up on how to act and what to bring when we can mix it up again. Helen Rosner is one of my favorite people in the world. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. She's always writing the smartest, most thoughtful articles about food. She also seems to know everything that's on the internet, and since that's where we do so much of our shopping now, I thought she'd be a great person to talk to about gifts we should buy for food people. Hey, Helen. It's great to talk with you.
Hi, Francis. Happy to be here.
All right. You are probably one of the most, well, certainly one of the most well-read people I know. You also have an exquisite eye for beautiful, delicious, and absurd things. So I want to talk with you about holiday gifts.
Oh, my what? Favorite topic.
I'm so glad. So, like, I want to know what we should be giving our food-loving friends this year. And can we start with practical or useful gifts?
Yeah. You know, I think that, like, practical or useful gifts, cooking tools, table settings, storage accessories are often people's first thought about what to give their food-loving friends and loved ones. And it can be a little bit of a trap, I think. You know, if you buy someone a tool, it's not quite like buying someone a vacuum cleaner and the sort of implied threat of you must maintain our home that's contained within that. But daily useful tools are just daily useful tools, right? If somebody mm-hmm. in your family cooks lunch or dinner for you every single day and you just get them another spatula, you're not really contributing to the happiness of their life. You're just sort of acknowledging that they do work for you, and here is something to help them keep doing that work. So I have a rule when I give people cooking tools and accessories, which is that they have to be really special. And special is a broad category. They can be special by being really expensive, though often that's the least interesting vector of specialness. You can be special by being unique, something that's handmade or something that is hard to get, maybe because you don't live near where it's made or it's you know, scarce. Or it can be special just because it's weird and you put a lot of work into it and it means something and it sort of speaks to the relationship you have to the person you're giving it to. So, for example, one of the things that I found in my recent obsessive pre-holiday gift shopping online browsing is an incredibly beautiful ceramic butter knife that if you think about a butter knife, I mean, why can't it be made out of ceramic, right? We know about ceramic bladed cutting knives and the sharpness of the ceramics. But for a butter knife, you know, we don't need it to cut anything. We just need it to spread. It can just be you could use a business card as a butter knife if the paper quality was high enough.
You just got me a great gift idea. Anyway, sorry, go on.
Well, so these butter knives are made by a Japanese artist named Sumiko Dugami, who hand forms, if you think of a basic butter knife shape, but made out of lovely glazed white ceramic with little blue glazed detailings along the handle. They're just simple shapes. Mm-hmm. They're really affordable. A really fantastic shop called Rikumo.com, where you can buy all sorts of handmade and artisan-made things from Japan, sells them for $14 each, which to me is the sweet spot for gift giving, right? Totally. Like it's perfect for like a stocking stuffer, for a good friend, for somebody who you maybe only kind of know, but you really like them. And it's so beautiful and it's so special. And it's the kind of thing where the act of buttering a piece of bread is suddenly made even more lovely by just using this perfect artist ceramic knife.
I love that.
So I love that.
Very nice. Yeah. Feed me more.
What else? Well, I don't know. Are you Are you right-handed or left-handed, Francis?
I am right-handed.
My husband is a lefty. I'm right-handed, like the majority, I think, of humans on Earth. But
yeah, I think 85%.
Being married to a left-handed person has taught me about all of the tiny ways that they are oppressed at all times, especially when it comes to using tools. And it had never occurred to me before that an angled spatula was an act of right-handed supremacy.
You're totally right. Because now I'm imagining using like my fish spatula with my left hand, and it's the wrong angle.
Yeah.
Like I would just be so confused.
Yeah. So I have found this absolutely beautiful wooden spoon / angled spatula that's made by a husband and wife team in West Virginia who operate a wood carving company called Allegheny Treenware. And they make this multi-purpose wooden spoon out of, you know, hardwood that they forage from the forests of West Virginia. It's got a little bit of a scoop in it to be a spoon, and it's got an angled edge with a bit of a point to be a spatula.
Oh, so you can like kind of scrape the bottom of the pan or whatever?
Yeah. It's $21, which is, again, in that perfect gift-giving sweet spot.
Yeah.
And the best part is when you order it online, you can select whether you want the right-handed or the left-handed
version of
the spoon.
Oh, I love it. Down with right-handed supremacy culture.
It's just these little acts of thoughtfulness. You know, I mean, I think the best thing that a gift can do for the recipient is have the recipient feel seen.
Oh, my God. Totally. The first gift I really remember being like, wow, was an immersion blender I got when I was 20 years old. I like had just started getting into cooking. I was like, oh, this cool tool. And I like made some offhand mention of it while at a shopping mall with my girlfriend at the time, and this is, you know, 20 some odd years ago, and all of a sudden at Christmas time, here's the box with an immersion blender in it, and it was just, I seriously almost cried because I just thought, like, you listen to me when I talk, and I'm just making some offhand comment about an immersion blender, and you remembered it 6 months later. And yeah, I think you're totally right. I think that is the magic of gift giving, when people feel like, oh, they really see you, they really hear you.
Yeah. I mean, an immersion blender is actually also a really fantastic gift. The truth is, you know, despite what I just said about how giving people sort of basic operating tools is a less than romantic option for gift giving, I actually think an immersion blender is one of those perfect kitchen appliances for gift giving, because if someone doesn't have one yet, their life will be forever changed.
Sure.
And it's entirely possible that people who don't have immersion blenders don't realize what they're missing. They get everything done, for the most part, that a regular blender gets done without dirtying another appliance.
Without having to clean the blender.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I mean, you can just stick it right into a pot of vegetables and stock that have been simmering together for a while, and like it does its little vortex thing, and suddenly you have this creamy, you know, carrot velouté or whatever you're going to call it today. They are terrifying, though. I think they might be the single most terrifying kitchen appliance to me, even more than a mandolin or a microplane.
I used to work in a kitchen, and like, you know, it was a big commercial kitchen, so we had like a giant immersion blender that was meant to go into 5 gallon buckets, so this thing looked like a garden tool. And we would joke that when the war between the waiters and the cooks finally came, someone would go grab the giant immersion blender and just wield it as a weapon, and the war would end right there. Anyway, let's keep going to more practical gifts than a 4-foot immersion blender.
Sure.
Pans? Do you have like pan thoughts?
Pans are so personal. Everybody's stove is different, and the way that you cook in a pan is different, you know, whether you're somebody who needs high straight edges or you're more of a classic frying pan shaped person. But I think a reliable, like, in fact, one of the most foolproof gift giving categories for somebody who loves food and cooking is vintage cast iron. And if you haven't fallen down the rabbit hole of vintage cast iron, though I'm sure you have, Francis.
I haven't really. But tell me
more. Oh, man. Well, you're in for a treat. They're crazy and amazing. So cast iron has been around since, I imagine, the Iron Age. So several thousand years, at least. But an interesting thing happened in the production of American cast iron cookware during World War II. Because of the needs of the military, they were not able to produce cast iron in the same alloys and ratios that they were previous to World War II. So sort of the demand for metal by the government kind of shifted the way that cast iron was produced. So you could buy brand new cast iron. It will be wonderful. There are a lot of amazing new forges that have started revisiting old cast iron techniques. They're classics like Lodge that are really affordable. They make perfectly serviceable cast iron.
Yeah.
But what I find to be super, super magical is cast iron that was created before about 1945. Even better if it's from 1930s, 1920s. And you can find it anywhere. I mean, there are tons of sellers on Etsy, for example, which is one of my favorite sources. There's an Etsy seller called Cast Iron Crusaders who have an entire shop that is refurbished cast iron. They put a lot of time into sourcing these amazing vintage pieces mm-hmm. and re-seasoning them and polishing them and bringing them up to be useful for everyday use.
Okay.
And
but what's the difference?
Well, so really old cast iron from, you know, one of the classic makers like Griswold, if it's from the 1920s or the 1930s, is going to be lighter weight than modern cast iron. They're thinner than modern cast iron. And instead of having the pebbled surface that we're probably used to from current commercial cast iron, they're very smooth. If they're properly seasoned, they'll often have almost a glassy looking surface. They are gorgeous, slick, flat pieces of metal that are a delight to cook on. And you're also holding this hunk of an elemental substance that has been in the hands of countless other people stretching back often well over a century. And unlike other heirloom pieces of kitchenware, they're not delicate. They're the opposite of delicate. I mean,
sure.
You don't have to treat it like it's breakable.
Yeah, you don't have to be all like tender with, you know, your grandparents' heirloom china or whatever. Like the point of this thing is it goes clunk on the stove and you cook food in it.
Exactly. And there are all sorts of amazing, weird cast iron things too. I mean, there's the classic skillets that come in all sorts of sizes, but there was an incredible tradition of American cast iron cornbread molds that are sometimes shaped like ears of corn. Or I once bought a cast iron pan. I think the seller wasn't even sure what it was supposed to be used for. That looks a little bit like a muffin tin, except instead of having flat-bottomed, slightly conic insets for the muffins or cupcakes, they were perfect half spheres. So you could make little half dome cakes of whatever you wanted. And it was from the late 1800s. I mean, it's like a Civil War era piece of cooking equipment that I keep in my kitchen drawer and I throw into the oven every couple of weeks.
That's so cool. And you get these little cutie cornbreads coming out of it.
Yeah. So I think that's a perfect gift for anybody who's into cooking, or even someone who isn't super into cooking but is into food and into food history, because they also look beautiful and they can be decorative just as much as they can be functional.
Super. We'll be back with more holiday gift ideas with The New Yorker's Helen Rosner, and then we're going to brush up on our etiquette for the holidays with the duo behind the podcast, Were You Raised by Wolves? I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking about holiday gifting and etiquette this episode, so let's get back to our chat about gift ideas with esteemed aesthete and New Yorker staff writer Helen Rosner. Okay, what about things that we can eat?
Oh, there are so many amazing options. And I'm a huge condiment fiend, and I think that
Same.
Giving condiments and receiving condiments is always a thrill. You know, you give someone like a hunk of meat or a whole cake, it's an obligation. But if you give somebody a condiment, a jar of mustard or a thing of a cool dipping sauce, then you're opening up a long-term possibility for them.
Sure.
You know, a little bit now, a little bit next week. My friend Matt introduced me to a sauce called Karam's garlic sauce. So Karam's garlic sauce is a Libyan garlic sauce. It's similar to toum, if you're familiar with that. It's basically a sort of emulsified puree of garlic and oil and salt. And if you go to garlicsauce.com, you find the website for Karam's garlic sauce, whose label, to me, looks a little bit like a Lebanese version of a Dr. Bronner's bottle. There's
extremely earnest soap maker Dr. Bronner,
exactly, whose labels are covered with more text than you can possibly read in one shower sitting. There's a photograph of the family matriarch Rose Karam on the label, and she's surrounded by writing in all sorts of like dozens of different fonts talking about how great this sauce is. It tastes good. It's good for you. Fresh raw garlic. You can use it on all sorts of things. And you can use it on all sorts of things. And it's unbelievably delicious.
And the label's right.
It comes in a bottle that actually looks a little bit like a shampoo bottle. It's tall and slim with a squeezy top. And I buy these bottles 3 or 4 at a time. And I always keep backups in the fridge. And I put them on everything and in everything. They're the base of all of my best vinaigrettes and marinades. Virtually any cuisine in the world that ever uses garlic, you can use this sauce to supplement.
It's just like a pure essence of oil and garlic.
Yeah, and I love it. And it's, you know, really affordable. And it's this cool small family business based on the West Coast. And it felt so special when my friend Matt told me about it. And I have given it to so many other people. And it always is just like indoctrinating somebody into the secret cult of Karam's magical garlic sauce.
Cool. What else? What else you got?
I don't know. Maybe I'm a Luddite, but I've been really skeptical of 3D printing sort of as a phenomenon, like for, you know, structural engineering.
A little bit scary.
A little scary. Also, like, a little, like, why? I mean, like, definitely makes sense for me if you're, like, making a prosthetic leg or coming up with a better way to make a structurally sound, cheaper to produce building material. But do we really need to be 3D printing our food? And I've found possibly the only definitive yes answer to that question from a company called Sugar Lab 3D, which does a lot of 3D printing, but the product they make that absolutely sold me on this, and I was just like, okay, fine, I'm in, I'm completely in, is a set of 3 bouillon cubes, except they're not cubes. They are 3D printed kimchi-flavored Korean soup bouillon.
Okay.
Which are 3D printed to look like a tiny little octopus, a head of Napa cabbage,
and a
fried chicken drumstick. They're so fun. And they come packaged like almost like chocolate bonbons, like in a cute little box. And you drop them into a pot of soup and they add that boost
kimchi
of,
oomph.
You know, that kimchi oomph. Exactly.
I love it.
They're the cutest things in the entire world. And I think like a box of 6 of them, they're not cheap on an item by item basis, right? A box of 6 of them runs about $19. But again, that's a perfect amount to spend on a gift for someone. They're really special. They're hilarious and so cute, and they actually taste fantastic and they make your cooking really fun.
I love it. What else? This is the easiest interview. I'll just keep going. What else?
Last year, sort of on a whim, I ordered myself a box of 4 dozen oysters that were overnighted to me FedEx from Island Creek Oyster Company, which is based in Massachusetts. It's amazing.
Go, girl.
Yeah. Look, you know, when you're feeling sad, order 48 oysters. Yeah. So Island Creek is a great oyster producer and distributor on the East Coast. They work with a lot of small independent aquaculture farmers up and down the East Coast, and they also have their own oyster beds in Massachusetts, and they ship all over the country. And because oysters are oysters, the shipping is all overnight. And it seems to me that you kind of can't do any better for a holiday gift than giving somebody a whole bunch of super fresh oysters that arrive on their doorstep ready to be shucked and devoured.
That is nice.
Yeah. But on the other hand, you can do one of my favorite gift-giving moves, which is the two-part gift, or if we want to get a little bit semiotic about it, the symbol and the object. So when it comes to oysters, for example, I could swing by my local grocery store, and virtually any supermarket will have a little section of housewares, right? Almost always, they will have, even if this grocery store has virtually no seafood section, for some reason, virtually every grocery store has an oyster shucking knife.
Really?
Yeah. I've been surprised by how frequently I've seen oyster shucking knives in grocery stores that really have no business having oyster shucking knives in them. An oyster shucker is probably a couple bucks. You can get a super fancy one for like $10 or $15, but you can also, you know, pick up a plastic handled one from wherever for like $3 or $4. Wrap that up, spend 10 minutes making a nice little IOU 2 dozen oysters note for one of your friends and give them that. And then whenever they're ready to receive the 2 dozen oysters, you can place the order for Island Creek to ship them oysters of whatever variety
tomorrow,
whenever it is that they're ready.
I love it. Yeah. What else can you get at a grocery store?
Oh, it's such an underrated place to go gift shopping, especially.
Really? Well, I love this.
Especially if you have a little bit of a sense of the absurd. I think one of the most important aspects of gift giving is absurdity. And one of the best gifts I think I ever gave was a few years ago. I had to buy a present for a friend. It was absolutely last minute. I had no time to go anywhere except the drugstore, actually. And okay. I knew she was a huge fan of gummy candies. And so I went to the candy aisle and I cleaned out their entire selection of Haribo and those gummy strawberries. Oh, nice. And basically nice. Any chewy candy. And I think volume is one of those perfect vectors for absurdity. Like, mm-hmm. you really like Hershey's Kisses? I bought you 5,000 Hershey's Kisses, right? Like, I cleaned out the grocery aisle of Hershey's Kisses or jars of peanut butter or boxes of Oreos or whatever it is. The key is to juxtapose it against incredibly beautiful gift packaging.
Yes.
So I filled a box with colorful tissue paper. I dumped these 35 bags of gummy candies on top of it, wrapped the box in gorgeous wrapping paper, tied a huge bow on the top, and then handed it to her like it was the Hope Diamond or something, just like the world's most valuable and exquisite present. And when she opened it, I think I have never given a more successful gift in my entire life. And that's the kind of thing, you know, as long as you know that someone likes something, buy them a ton of it and wrap it really well.
Well, you know, I love it because, A, it's really funny to open a beautiful present and have it, wow, that's a lot of beef jerky. But holy cow, I love beef jerky. And you know what? Here's the key. You know I love beef jerky. Oh, my God. Like, yeah. You know I love beef jerky. You know I love gummy bears. Yeah. That's really sweet.
Yeah.
Okay, what about books? What books are you given this year?
Oh, I'm so into so many cookbooks this year. This was such an incredible year for cookbooks. But one of my favorite cookbooks that I'm going to be giving a lot of people as a gift is called Tables of Contents, the community cookbook. Tables of Contents is a supper series here in Brooklyn that's basically an amazing dinner party celebrating authors and literature. And at each meal, when it pops up, it sort of doubles as a book club and a dinner party. So recipes that are inspired by or based on books. And often the authors of the books actually attend the Tables of Contents meal, which makes it really special. And this year they've published a cookbook called the Tables of Contents Community Cookbook, where they've asked a whole bunch of writers to contribute some of their favorite recipes. So it's kind of like a church cookbook, but for the coolest writers you've ever heard of. It's like Carmen Maria Machado, who's one of my all-time favorite authors. I think she's brilliant.
Amazing sci-fi writer.
Yeah, yeah. She does like this incredible sort of like spooky queer horror that's just unbelievable. Has her recipe for a pineapple pecan cheese ball, like a perfect retro entertaining recipe. Leanne Shapton, who is a brilliant author and a fantastically expressive illustrator, has a recipe for crumbly peanut butter cookies. Basically, if there's a cool author who has published a book in the last, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, odds are good they're going to have a recipe in this cookbook that they've contributed. And it's such an amazing glimpse inside their minds.
I love this. I super love this. What else?
I've been a huge fan of Joanne Lee Molinaro's Instagram for a really long time. I don't know if you follow her. Her handle
is... The Korean Vegan.
Yeah, The Korean Vegan. And this year she came out with her first cookbook, which, appropriately enough, is also called The Korean Vegan. And it's so good. I am not vegan. Not even a little bit. And, you know, I try to, you know, like a good conscientious human, I try to modulate my intake of animal products. But this cookbook, despite having vegan on the cover, despite being suffused with really brilliant substitutions for many of the traditional Korean ingredients that are really rooted in flavors, you know, based on fish, based on shrimp, things like that, is just brilliant. Like, not that vegan is a negative modifier, but this cookbook does not require vegan as a modifier. It's not the best vegan cookbook of the year. It's one of the best cookbooks of the year, period. Molinaro takes really classic recipes, spicy tofu soup, a whole selection of banchan, you know, the tiny sort of vegetable-forward appetizers that come along with a Korean meal, and presents these beautiful recipes for them that are often rooted in tradition, are sometimes clever contemporary spins that are out of her kitchen or her mother's or her grandmother's, because it also is a record of their immigration to the U.S. and their attempts at assimilation and the difficulties and also the pleasures of being an immigrant here. And it's just a thrilling, exuberant cookbook.
Cool. Well, this is a super list. I'm excited to give gifts this year.
Oh, I love to hear that.
And thank you for joining us.
This was so fun. Happy gift giving.
Happy gift giving. Helen Rosner is a staff writer at The New Yorker. You can find her list of gift ideas at splendidtable.org. Okay, so maybe you got a little practice socializing with people at Thanksgiving, but are you really, really in game shape? Because I'm not giving up hope that sometime in the near future we'll be fully able to mix again. And have you forgotten all the social situations you get into every normal year at this time? You know, office parties, New Year's parties, holiday parties, cookie swaps. I just learned about those. And maybe you want to prepare for a time when you can actually have people over to your house again. Well, I have no idea what any of that looks like anymore, and I need some help. So maybe you do too. It is our great pleasure, then, that we can be of service to you by bringing you the etiquette stylings of Leah Bonema and Nick Layton. They are the hosts of the excellently named podcast, Were You Raised by Wolves?
Ow!
And they're here with us now. Hey, Nick and Leah.
Hey there.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
So happy to have you. Thank you for replying to our invitation, which I know was the polite thing to do. So you're already starting on a wonderful foot. I have to say, while I was preparing for this interview, I certainly stepped into a rabbit hole reading up on, you know, the OG of American etiquette, Emily Post. And I learned that they are literally five generations of posts deep. Like, this is a family that has been continuously doling out etiquette advice for literally over 100 years. So that's amazing. But how did you get into the world of etiquette? And, you know, did you ever or would you ever want to go to charm school?
I think that question's for me, Leah. So, I mean, for me, I grew up in a very multicultural household, and we could even call it like a mini commune in Northern California.
Okay.
So there was just a lot of people from many different backgrounds coming and going. And so growing up, I just intersected with a lot of different traditions, and I always found that fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I always loved seeing how different traditions approach the same question or problem in different ways. Mm. And so for me, that's what etiquette and manners are. You know, manners is like the universal for like everything. Like, we all agree on certain manners, like we should be kind to each other. But etiquette is how a specific society or culture sort of expresses that manner.
Oh,
and so I always love seeing how that's different in different places. I mean, that's why I love traveling to different places, just to see how other people do what they do. And so what I love about our show and the questions that we get is that it is so universal.
Mm.
It is so universal, these problems, these questions, these issues, these conundrums. Globally, we all have these same questions and anxieties, and it's kind of wonderful. It's very sort of uniting in some way.
Oh, that's kind of lovely. Yeah, no one knows what to do.
Yeah, I know.
A lot of us don't. But what's nice, and I think what really gives me hope for the future, is that everyone wants to try and do the right thing. No one is out there actively trying to do the wrong thing. We don't know what the right thing is all the time, but we all want to do that, whatever that is.
Okay, that's a generous take on it. And Leah, what about you? How did you get interested?
I feel like I'm at this nice intersection of, I'm a stand-up comic, and I think I have this like sort of deep love for humanity and people and wanting people to feel good. And then also I'm in a perpetual state of anxiety and embarrassing myself. So I think I'm a very good person to be like, I totally did this wrong. Let's figure out how we can think about it so next time it doesn't happen, so I don't lay awake all night worrying about it. And I think really lock into our audience with that chronic fear.
You seem particularly well-adjusted for a stand-up comic then. Yeah.
I mean, thank you so much. It's been a lot of work.
I mean, we're grading on a curve, though.
Let's be honest. I mean.
All right. So I am doubly glad to have you all here then, because there are lots of awkward situations, I think, as we head. Well, let's not call them awkward. Potentially awkward situations that we all want to make sure we're doing the right thing in. I wanted to ask you some questions about how to navigate some potential situations. I think especially since many of us are a little bit out of practice being around other human beings. So let's say you're invited to a party at someone's house. And because we were not raised by wolves, we know to ask them, well, what can we bring? And they say the worst answer to this question ever. Oh, just whatever. What are you supposed to do?
So we actually just got a question this week from somebody who asked, like, oh, what can I bring? And the host gave them the entire grocery list.
It's a phenomenal question. Nick and I are like, we're going to have to open a new category for this question. When did that happen?
What was your plan if I didn't ask you what I was going to bring? Was there going to be any food? Were you going to go shopping?
I think that's definitely when people say, whatever, don't worry about it. I think that's when we bring like a lovely host or hostess gift.
Yeah. I mean, I think definitely not showing up empty-handed is nice. Although Miss Manners, I think she would give you permission to show up empty-handed. Because for her, it's all about reciprocation. So I'll have you over to my house. I'll go over to your house. And then, you know, that's the exchange. I don't need to be bringing tea towels and candles. But tea towels and candles, those are nice gifts.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about hostess gifts for a minute. Because I don't know what they are.
Well, is that even the right term? Should we modernize the term hostess gift?
Yeah, because there's that piece of it, like the gendering of it. And like even like the term hostess gift sort of has connotations of, like you said, maybe like tea towels or candles. But like if it's really, oh, whatever, should I bring a dessert? Because if you already have dessert plan, maybe there's second dessert and everyone's just extra happy because who's going to be sad about a second dessert? Or do I bring a bottle of something to drink? Like I just don't know like what scale of participation. Or to your point, maybe if they really say whatever, they actually mean whatever and doesn't matter and like just have me over sometime. Like what can we assume?
Well, first, you don't have to ask. You know, that's not required that you ask what you can bring. You can just bring something that's thoughtful and nice. Mm. And the energetics here is just, I want to express gratitude for you offering me hospitality. And so that's the point of this. It doesn't need to be extravagant. It doesn't need to be, you know, something grand. But it's just like, oh, I am so happy that you had me over. Here's a little something. And that little something needs to be something that is not required for that evening. Mm. So definitely don't bring something you expect to be served or opened or used at that meal. That is the number one complaint from hosts, is that like, oh, this person brought a casserole. I already have my menu done. I don't need this casserole.
The second dessert, I was like, no one minds a second casserole, maybe not so necessary.
I love the term second dessert because it feels like it should be in Lord of the Rings, like second breakfast. But we have discussed, a lot of people do write in, as Nick said, about how they already had the menu. So I feel like a host or hostess would say, hey, I don't have desserts, or bring a beverage if that's what they wanted. Mm-hmm. But if they say bring anything or I don't need anything, as Nick said, that's when you bring something where you assume it's not going to be put out that evening. There's no pressure for them to work it into the night.
Okay. I like that. That's a good guide. I've totally seen someone bring a bottle of wine, get huffy they didn't open the wine, and then bring the bottle of wine home with them at the end of the night. I assume.
Woo!
Ooh, that's an etiquette
crime. A bad look.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Whatever you bring, you have to leave that.
Yeah. Okay. Rule number two, leave the thing you brought.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely.
We're going to be back in a minute with more from Leah Bonema and Nick Layton from the podcast, Were You Raised by Wolves? And then we've got some inspiration for homemade food gifting from Serious Eats' Daniel Gritzer. Stick around. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking about how to host with the most and guest with the best in, okay, maybe optimistic preparation for this holiday season. And for that, we're chatting with the duo from the fabulous Etiquette podcast, Were You Raised by Wolves? Leah Bonema and Nick Layton. Let's get back to it with them. Okay, so after the dinner's over, thank you notes.
Yes. Next question.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's the answer. Yes. Because I don't know, a little bit like we're more informal now. Am I doing too much if I write a thank you note? But your answer is yes.
I mean, do we want to live in a world in which there's such thing as too much gratitude? Like, is that going to be a problem?
I feel like he's thinking really hard.
But to your point.
I'm just thinking about what people might say to that.
But to your point, yes. Is a handwritten thank you note with a quill always required?
No.
No. But I think it's always nice to express appreciation for something nice that somebody did for you. And so yeah, it could be proportionate to what that thing was. If a neighbor grabbed your newspaper one morning, like, you don't have to do a handwritten thank you note. A thank you text is fine. If you're invited to someone's house for a 5-course degustation menu with, you know, waiter service, then yeah, I think a handwritten note would be nice.
Yeah.
So you can just do something that's proportionate. But I think to not acknowledge gratitude, I don't think we want to live in that world.
I'm with you. I like that.
I don't want to live in that world.
Oh, okay. So actually, here's a question. Sorry, I probably should have asked before chronologically, but let's get to it anyway because it's important. Are you for or against people offering to help you clean up? Is it tacky to offer? Is it tacky to not offer?
Leah?
I always want to offer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I always want to offer. I don't think I would ever want to take that away from my personality. Maybe somebody needs help. It's overwhelming. They want... Also, we can hang out in the kitchen and gossip. You know what I mean? I always want to offer. I feel like it's up to the host whether they want to accept or not. Nick, how do you feel about that?
I think fine to offer, depending on what kind of event it is. I mean, if you're having dinner at Buckingham Palace, I don't think you offer to clean up.
Yeah, so. I would not offer at Buckingham Palace. Let me make this clear. This is at a friend's house.
But I think if you are rebuffed, then don't insist. And especially this time of year when people bring out their good china, people are very sensitive about their dishes and they don't want them stacked. They don't necessarily want them in the dishwasher. Like, just let them handle it. So, you know, I think it's okay to just take no for an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Right on. Oh, I like that. Because I think that, are there rules? Yes, maybe there are rules. But really what you're talking about is like, how do you empathize, right? Like, how do you sort of like put yourself in the role of the person who's on the other side of that conversation?
I mean, you just cracked the code. That's what this is all about. Yes, that other people exist.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what etiquette is at the end of the day. It's just that other people exist and that we want to be mindful of their time and their space and their feelings and their property. And everything we do, all the etiquette answers, really kind of go through that lens. And if you ever want to know, like, oh, what is the correct etiquette response? It's what will maximize that.
So how do I get people to leave my house in a nice way? Which I'm actually kind of serious. Like, that's the thing, too. It's like, had a great party. Love you. So glad we can do this again. I'm going to go to bed. And you're just opening another bottle. How do I get out of the situation?
Yeah, I mean, this happens.
It happens a lot.
Common issue.
I feel like I like to try to deal with things in advance so I don't worry about it. And so I like to send out, if I'm hosting an event, do you want to be here from 5 to 10? So they know there was an out time. So that way when I prepare to make it obvious that everybody needs to go, in my mind I can say, I've already warned people there was going to be an out time. I don't have to feel rude about it.
Yeah. I like that. Just pulling out my eye mask in the middle of conversation is not...
Yeah, you're just like, oh, I'm putting on my night cream. Yeah. Is this obvious? Yeah.
And for a lot of meals, there's actually a natural progression to the evening. You know, we're having dinner, and then now dinner's over. And in kidnapping, it's bad. But at a dinner party, you do want to go to a secondary location. You know, we're going to take our coffee and dessert in the living room now. And that's kind of everybody's signal that, like, oh, it's sort of wrapping up. And so you kind of have those subtle hints. There are definitely people in all of our lives that don't take those hints. That just
for
don't
sure.
take them, don't get them, just ignore them. And I think once you're already in your pajamas and you're ready to go to bed, that's when you just have a polite yet direct conversation, which is like, it was so lovely, but I do need to go to bed. And so here is the door.
Absolutely.
That's the key move.
Or you can go my way, which is invite people over. Hey, guys, I have extra socks. I have face masks. Let's stay and watch all the Star Wars. And then you see people packing up and leaving immediately. I'm so ready for a sleepover. And that makes everybody want to bounce. You could try that.
Yeah.
You think she's joking.
You think I'm joking, yeah. But I am not.
No. She has pajamas in all sizes ready to go.
Okay, last question. I've heard there's like a rule about like candle wicks.
Oh, yes. But once I tell you this thing, you cannot unknow it. Your life will forever be bifurcated by this moment. It's Gwyneth Paltrow sliding doors. That's what's about to happen to you. So there is this very old etiquette rule that you can never have fresh candles on display. You always have to blacken the wicks first. And there are many reasons for this. Miss Manners says that the reason is that you want to indicate that the candles aren't just for show, that they're actually being used. And it kind of fits into the same world of you don't want to offer things to your guests that they can't use.
Oh.
That's why guest soap that they're not allowed to use and the guests guest bathroom is also kind of rude. It's like, why is this soap here if I can't use it? And so candles that are being offered to guests that actually aren't usable because they're not lit, that's sort of in this same flavor of like, oh, let's not do that. So you're supposed to blacken the wicks first, just for a second. Just, you know, light them, blow them out, that's fine. But you can't have something unblackened in your home. Another explanation, which is kind of fun, is that when electricity was new, only rich people had it. And so rich people didn't want you to know they were rich or didn't want to show off. And so they would blacken their wicks to make it seem like they still used candles, even though they didn't need to use candles. So, you know, I kind of like that answer, too. Like, oh, that's fun. Totally unnecessary. This. But, like, so many of these edit rules are. But that's historical.
What's fun is you'll be watching TV now and you'll see unblackened wicks and you'll be like, okay, who didn't blacken their wicks?
Yeah, you're going to see unblackened wicks everywhere now, and it's going to bother you, and I apologize.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a wild ride, wilder than I thought it would be when we started talking about, well, let's talk about manners at a dinner party. But I guess this is why you have the most popular relationship show in all of podcasting.
Definitely when it comes to the etiquette side.
I love that. That's so nice to say.
And we obviously have that handwritten thank you note in the mail.
Ready to go.
All right. Thanks so much, Nick and Leah.
Thank you. This was a treat.
Real treat.
Nick Layton and Leah Bonema are the hosts of the podcast, Were You Raised by Wolves? So I have never been a knitter. I can't sew or crochet, and there will come a time when I have to start trying to assemble my kids' toys and will just fail at it. But one thing I can do is make something tasty and put it in a jar. And I bet you're the same way because you are listening to The Splendid Table and not like The Splendid Sewing Machine. So we wanted to bring on Daniel Gritzer. He's a culinary director and one of the resident food science nerds of the terrific website Serious Eats to talk about some great homemade food gifts. Hey, Daniel, it's great to have you.
Hey, Francis, it's great to be here. Thank you so much.
So I have to tell you, we were looking for ideas for food gifts, like our Splendid Table team, and I have to tell you, we kind of all fell in love with a listicle on Serious Eats, which maybe that's never been said before, where we fell in love with this listicle. But anyway, it was honestly full of super great ideas and recipes. And so what are some of the ones that you look at this list and you're like, oh, dude, I might make that this year?
So I have one recipe by Stella Parks for homemade hot chocolate mix. And I have one savory recipe by Sola El Whaley for homemade chili crisp.
Oh, I love it.
It's inspired by the Lao Gan Ma brand chili crisp, which I'm pretty sure is the one that really kicked off the chili crisp obsession.
Sure.
You know, I think the story is with a woman with a noodle stand in China. Her aromatic chili oil topping became sort of more popular than even her noodle dishes themselves. And so she jarred it up and it eventually reached international fame and then inspired so many sort of artisan and small batch chili crisp products. Something you can make at home actually quite easily and in large batches, which is nice for gifting. It's easier to divide it up and divvy it out. So it starts with, obviously, your chilies. And these are dried chilies we're talking about. And our recipe uses a combination of arbol chilies, Japanese chilies, and Kashmiri chilies. But you really can just get creative there. Change the heat level, choose hotter chilies, more mild chilies, chilies with different flavor profiles, something smoky like a chipotle. It's really anything is possible. And then there's usually some sort of spice dimension, commonly Sichuan peppercorns, other spices, ginger. This is just speaking very, very generally. And then something crispy. And then that original Lao Gan Ma product, it's crispy soybeans that give you that nice kind of lightly crunchy texture. So in our recipe, what Sola does is she really rounds out the spices. So we've got ginger, star anise, there's cardamom, Sichuan peppercorns. She pushes the umami on it. So in addition to, some MSG, which anybody who wants to leave it out can, there's also mushroom powder, which is a very savory umami ingredient.
Yeah, delicious.
And then for the crispy element in this recipe, there's both peanuts instead of the soybeans and crispy fried garlic and shallots.
I love it.
So, and also that's giving you all this aromatic dimension as well. And so the process is you stem and seed the chilies, you grind them up in a spice grinder so you have a kind of coarse chili powder, fry the garlic and the shallots, thinly sliced, preferably on a mandolin so it's nice and even so you get even cooking and an even crisping throughout.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you take that oil that the garlic and the shallots were fried in, you get it really hot, and you just pour it right on top of those ground chilies along with the spices. And that all just infuses that hot oil with the chili flavor and the spice. And of course, the heat of chilies is soluble in oil, so you're really pulling it out into the oil. Okay. And then the crispy garlic and shallots go back in. So once you kind of have that framework, you can change the chilies, like I was saying. You can change your spicing. You can change the aromatic. You know, maybe you don't want crispy shallots in it. You know, you can completely...
Maybe there's something wrong with you and you don't want crispy shallots in it.
I'm not going to judge.
Oh, I love that. So, okay, so it's not like a long, slow process in the pot. Like, you're not really toasting the spices individually. It just sounds like you can get them all together and that hot oil goes on top and just instantly yes. toast the spices, toast the chilies.
Yeah.
And you kind of let it just sort of settle and then you're good. Like, you bottle that up and ship it to your friends.
Exactly. And it'll continue to extract flavor over time as it sits and will likely grow hotter over time as it sits. It should be refrigerated, although it's stable enough that, you know, I think you have a window of time in the gifting phase where it can be, you know, jarred up and handed over, but should get back in the fridge, you know, afterwards. It keeps for like, you know, 3 months refrigerated. Although I have to say, no one I know who has made this has ever reported it staying that long. I mean, this stuff just disappears.
I love it. Okay, what about the hot chocolate mix? Tell us about that.
I love this one because, first of all, it's so easy because it's just put everything in a food processor, blitz it, and you're done. So then it's sort of the only okay. question is, well, what is everything? and what's really nice here is, once again, we have Stella's recipe and you can follow it to the letter, but you can also change it up. There's dark chocolate,
okay,
you know, like actual like bar form dark chocolate, which is going to melt and give really just chocolatey intensity and that wonderful kind of body. And then there's also white chocolate, which enhances that cocoa butter quality and also enhancing the texture even further. And then you do also have on top of that Dutch process cocoa powder, which it's gone through an alkaline treatment and that reduces kind of the acidity that cocoa powder can have. And it also interestingly dissolves more easily, the Dutch process, compared to natural cocoa powder.
Oh, interesting.
And then Stella goes even farther. There's instant espresso powder. And of course, espresso and coffee are bedfellows with dark chocolate, with those deep, yeah. dark, roasty flavors. This is not going to make the hot chocolate taste like coffee, but it's just going to add to that complexity and that intensity of that roasty flavor profile.
Yeah,
and then,
love that.
You know, Stella's pulling out all the stops here. So then malted milk powder goes in, which she has, I love this, she has dubbed it the umami of the baking world.
Oh, sure.
I don't know how you feel, but I'm just crazy for it. It's one of my favorite things. And then Stella has this fascinating thing. It's toasted sugar. Back in 2011, there was a study that revealed that the whole process of caramelization that happens with sugar, you know, I think when most of us think of making caramel, we think of the sugar melting.
Yeah, yeah.
And this study that Stella found makes it clear that that's not actually the case. They are two totally independent processes, the melting and the caramelizing of the sugar. They just happen to coincide most of the time because we tend to make caramel over high enough heat that they're both sort of being triggered at once. So realizing that, Stella realized that she could put granulated sugar into a, you know, a moderate oven, what, 300 degrees or so, and caramelize the sugar without melting it.
Oh, that's so cool.
So Stella's hot chocolate mix calls for this toasted sugar. It's very easy to make. It's literally just put sugar in your oven. and it gives that complex, roasted, little bit bitter, less sweet flavor.
I love it. And yeah. just all that in a blender to mix it all up and then put those in little jars with a cute little bow on top.
Yep. And that doesn't have to go in the fridge or anything.
Cool. So, okay, I'm going to get a whole bunch of jars and get to work. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you, Francis.
Daniel Gritzer is the culinary director of Serious Eats, and you can find those homemade food gift ideas at splendidtable.org. And that's our show for the week. Have fun out there and take care of each other, will you? Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. And if you don't already, check out our podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to get yours. Subscribe to our weekly recipe newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Sign up at splendidtable.org. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith.
Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios. All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.